From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today, we'll learn about the good and bad mental health implications of being a sports fanatic. Then, we'll learn about the nationwide nursing shortage and how it's impacting hospitals in Wisconsin.
In the beginning of the pandemic, we rallied. People were helping from all different areas. The community was there. And then as time has worn on, the exhaustion has set in.
Plus, we'll tell you about a new book that celebrates the progression of the Milwaukee River Greenway.
When I moved here in 1977, happened to find the Greenway, it was considered dangerous. The book includes much of the history. An important piece of that history is the transformation that's happened.
Lake Effect is next, but first, the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. For the third season in a row, the Brewers were knocked out of the first round of the postseason. After winning the NL Central title, hopes were high for the Brew Crew, but they fell in their first series to the Atlanta Braves. For many people, the sports team they support can be a major factor of their identity. But when does enthusiasm cross the line to fanaticism? Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski spoke to Dr. Stephen Franzoy, Professor Emeritus of Psychology at Marquette University, about how sports fandom can impact mental health.
Well, I think where there are some red flags where you get in fisticuffs after watching your team and you start throwing things around, or perhaps if your team loses, your mood is deteriorating rapidly over the next few days, that's probably an indication you're a little too involved in your sports team than maybe you should be. Maybe you should disengage a bit and engage in other activities that give you a sense of self-worth.
Yeah, well, in that aspect of identity, right, where a team's outcome is greatly impacting yourself and your life, how does team identification play a role in this to the same extent that people identify with nationality, ethnicity, or even gender?
Good point. I mean, that's a great question. And actually, it's the same psychological process. Our sense of patriotism, our sense of ethnic identity, our sense of family identity are all aspects of what we call the social identity. And they're important aspects of our overall self-concept. And for a lot of people, identification with a sports team has absolutely no relevance to their sense of identity. But there are a number of people that where it's as important as maybe their national identity, or maybe even more so than their ethnic identity. As a social identity, we gain a sense of self-worth when our group succeeds and we experience a personal a sense of defeat when our team loses. And, you know, we had no part in it. We might have been looking at it on television, and thus there was no impact we have at all, unless you believe in paranormal forces. It has an impact on how we view ourselves and our mood during the day.
And another realm that is added to this is not just, you know, pride in having a winning team, right? But the social connectedness is probably one of the biggest reasons for following a team or being a sports fanatic. Do you think the pandemic has put people and team pride into overdrive, both when things are going well and going badly?
I do think that, you know, we're getting back to normal social activities, and for a long time, we weren't able to go into a sports arena, a sports venue next to other people. And so I think there's that welcome relief and with it, maybe some extra enthusiasm, but also maybe for a lot of people, there's also some added anxiety about that thing. So I think it cuts both ways. There's probably a rush of emotions, which is again, typical of a sports arena or any kind of venue where you have a strong social identity with a group.
And on that note of a strong social identity with the group, can you explain a bit more about de-individualization and what happens when that happens to a fan?
Yeah, de-individuation is where you lose a sense of your sense of identity. It often happens when you're in a large group setting or it's dark out where it's hard to identify people, and like a mob behavior, but also in a, you know, in a sports arena where it's hard to single people out and I see what they're doing and attribute perhaps some aggressive behavior toward them or some antisocial behavior. And when you have this de-individuated state, people are more likely than normal, when they can be personally identified very easily, to act on impulse and to not engage in self-control. The area of our neocortex that controls our impulses, you know, and sort of stops us from engaging in those kind of behaviors, sometimes is disengaged during those times of de-individuation.
So it's like losing your sense of personal responsibility or giving yourself a pass?
Right. Yes.
Okay. And I think, of course, there's a big wide-ranging scale to this. You know, you can have a pretty expected example, like when the Bucks are playing in Phoenix and the opposing team fans are doing the free throw countdowns. You know, it's distracting, but it's not, you know, to the level of physically hurting someone, which has happened both to other team fans, players. I'm thinking how much animosity LeBron got when he was leaving the Cleveland Browns. You know, some stuff drives people to pose real threats towards others.
Yeah. And it's the same kind of thing that you have in warfare, where you have two groups, two tribes, two countries, two sets of armies going at it. And there's this very strong sense of personal identity, social identity among each group, and a devaluing and a depersonalization of the other group, that they're less than human, if not more like animals. And thus we feel as though we are entitled to behave in an antisocial and dehumanizing way toward that other group. That can also happen in a sports venue to a much less degree. We aren't going to actually literally kill people, but you hear the language in a lot of sports where it is talking about, we really killed them, we annihilated them. Some of the same language that you hear in warfare. And I think it taps into our evolutionary heritage of being small groups of people who are competing for scarce resources with other small groups of people. And our successes become their failures, their successes become our failures.
We talked a little bit about superstition. What other kind of methods have fans perfected for coping to justify, you know, maybe some overzealous fan base, or no matter how well or badly their team is doing, they are staunchly behind them and how it impacts their identity and their self-esteem?
Well, okay, you mentioned superstitious behavior. So, you know, I have not been immune to changing my jersey number when I'm watching the Packers, because I think that, you know, number 66 is not really delivering on the field right now for them. So I switched to maybe number 15 or number 12, you know, and then when something completely unconnected to what I'm doing at my home with the clothes I'm wearing, when something positive happens, I might then attribute it to, you know, that I had an impact there. So there's a lot of irrational behavior. You know, you can talk about athletes. A lot athletes go through a lot of superstitious behavior, but so do fans. And fans really have virtually nothing to do with the outcome on the field, especially when they're watching it on television. But that doesn't stop us from getting a sense of that we have some sort of personal control. And that's really important, that human beings, their anxiety lessons if they think they have some personal control over an uncontrollable situation, whether it's heart surgery or whatever it is, job interviews, sporting events. If you believe that you can do something to proactively then change the outcome, and it doesn't matter if you have nothing to do with that at all, that your actions will not change it at all. If you believe it, it will lower your anxiety and make you feel better.
So how do we all take a collective deep breath when it comes to recognizing when this can become harmful and goes beyond, you know, I want the Bucks to do well. I'm from Milwaukee, but, you know, I'm not going to lose sleep. I'm not going to go into a spiral for a few days if something happens. But of course, I want them to win. But, you know, how do we just take a step back and recognize when these behaviors can become detrimental?
Well, you've just identified by your self-description a non-rabid fan. So okay. There's a lot of people who are going to be, if the Bucks lose and then goes to game seven and they lose again, there's a lot of Bucks fans that are going to have a hard time over the next week. If that does happen, then what my suggestion to them is that they focus on some other activity in their life that gives them personal satisfaction. Stop listening to the news, reading the paper, and engage in some other activity to make yourself feel better. Try to avoid poring over things that have to do with the game. Again, that'll be might be hard for them to do that, but that's psychologically a good strategy to use.
Well, and on the flip side, if Bucks continue to do well and score some wins, what does that do for our mental health?
For the very strong fans, it will improve their mental health, their outlook. They'll be good people to be around. They will be generous. They're more likely to donate to causes that have no relevance at all to the Milwaukee Bucks. They're more likely to help other people out. And so that's going to be great. And that will benefit them. And I would encourage those fans to then read as much of the media as possible, to bask in what we call reflected glory. It's called BIRGing, for the acronym BIRG, basking in reflected glory. It will put a bounce in their step for quite a while. They'll feel the sense of personal accomplishment. Again, they had nothing to do with it, but that doesn't mean anything. So I would just tell them to enjoy it. And I certainly know what that feels like because, you know, I'm a sports fan too.
Dr. Stephen Franzoy is a professor emeritus of psychology at Marquette University. He spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski in July. It's been a rough couple years for medical professionals. They've been putting their lives at risk to help our communities survive during the pandemic, and many of them are feeling the physical and emotional toll. For nurses, it's been especially difficult. Nursing shortages caused by increased competition for employees, fewer people entering the field, and people quitting or retiring have meant that nurses who remain are working even harder to make sure hospitals can keep running. Mary Beth Kingston is all too familiar with how much hospitals depend on the work of nurses. She's the chief nursing officer for Advocate Aurora Health, and she joined me last month.
We have a shortage of nurses right now in Wisconsin, and that can have a huge impact on our healthcare systems. Just for reference, what are some of the things nurses take care of at a hospital?
Oh, boy. First of all, I have to say we have a shortage of nurses throughout the country right now. So this is it's greater than Wisconsin. Nurses, to me, are really the glue that holds the healthcare system together. I mean, we're in hospitals, which is, I think, where people are very familiar with seeing nurses. But we're also in clinics, all of the clinic settings. We're in people's homes. We're in the community, running support groups, helping new moms at home. So we're really in every aspect and setting where you would see healthcare being delivered.
You mentioned this is a nationwide shortage. It's also something that we've been dealing with for a number of years. This isn't something that just popped up during the pandemic. What has been happening at hospitals, specifically your hospital, as a result of not enough nurses necessarily to do the work?
Well, you know, I've been a nurse for 44 years, so you're right. We've had nursing shortages. We have peaks and valleys, and many times we've been able to really get that supply and demand right where it needs to be. And I would say the years prior to the pandemic, actually, we were doing quite well. A lot of people very interested in nursing careers. We're looking for diverse candidates. We're partnering with schools. So that's been wonderful. But the pandemic really did challenge all of us and highlight a number of issues, I think, that we have to address. So number one, right now, what we're seeing is just kind of the perfect storm of things coming together. We, in the beginning of the pandemic, we rallied. People were helping from all different areas. The community was there. And then as time has worn on, the exhaustion has set in. And certainly we also needed to get back to the business of caring for patients. And then we continue to have these surges, and we're obviously in the midst of another surge now. So that impacts nurses tremendously. And those that are on the cusp of maybe retiring say, well, you know what, I maybe this is the right time for me to do that. Another thing that's happened, so there's all of these factors at play, is because of the nationwide shortage, travel agencies, nurses going to travel to different locations, they have really increased their salaries tremendously, making it extremely attractive for people to really leave their families and go to, and certainly if you have the ability to do that, but go to some of the travel nursing organizations and work in other places. So we, as in many places across the country, have seen some loss there as well. The other thing is the workforce, it's the workplace itself. As leaders, we really need to focus on making this an environment that's supportive, that people want to be in. And we have, again, across the country, had issues with workplace violence at times. And we've seen that increase a bit during the pandemic, where there might be folks who don't want to mask, or they, you know, don't want to follow some of the rules, regulations. And we've also had to restrict visiting, which has caused tremendous distress for our nurses, and specifically for our patients and their families. So there's lots of factors that are playing into this right now.
You mentioned just the exhaustion, and you just said the job is... It doesn't get easier when there are fewer people to do it. And the pandemic has resulted in a lot of emotions among people who have lost loved ones, who can't be with their loved ones, or people who don't really believe that the pandemic has been as difficult as it has been. How are you as a system dealing with the kind of trauma that many nurses are experiencing?
Yeah, that's a great question, because, you know, initially we focused on the immediate need. So we jumped into action. We had a family care stipend that covered childcare where children weren't in school. We looked at folks that were having financial difficulty and said, you can cash in, double your PTO. So we put hotels if you don't want to go home, really supporting kind of the basic needs. We also have a support fund for our team members, and we spent, I think, almost $2 million at this point from that if people are having issues. But as you mentioned, now we're moving into a little bit of a different phase where it's longer term. And yes, financial incentives and compensation are great, but that's a short-term thing. And we really do have to address the stress and trauma that people are experiencing. So another thing that we work on, it sounds very simple, but it's really important, is helping people to connect to their purpose. And the purpose of, you know, people go into healthcare because they want to help people. And how do we continue to focus on that? Again, that's one strategy. So we do daily messaging, provide information in huddles for leaders. Another thing that I think is really important, when I talk to nurses all the time, and we have, as many places do, we have a structure called shared governance, where nurses meet and they make decisions about their practice. And I and other leaders work with those nurses. And we often ask them, what would you find helpful? Because I can sit and think of a million things that might be helpful that might not really impact folks who are providing care. And they often say that they get their greatest source of support from their coworkers. And so we have a very robust, and it's really for everyone in our system, but a peer-to-peer support program called Together as One, where we have volunteers and they come from all different disciplines and they go through some additional training, but then they're back there in the work setting and they have additional training to help identify when someone is struggling, or to help people get to the various. We have so many strategies in place. But when you're busy and taking care of patients, you're not often thinking, oh, yes, I'm going to call employee assistance, or, you know, I have a chaplain who I can reach 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. You just are kind of getting through your shift. But if you have coworkers that are there and a leader and a manager who's there really checking in on you and seeing how you're doing, then those individuals can then help connect people to the resources that we have available.
A lot of that speaks to retention, retaining nurses who are on staff. You mentioned previously that before the pandemic, there were nursing shortages, but you had success with these programs that were getting people into the system, getting people into the places that you needed them. What is that work looking like right now?
Yeah, we're doing a number of different things. The one thing, again, when we ask our team members what is helpful, they often mention compensation as well. So that's something that we've taken a good hard look at and have definitely been reviewing and putting into place additional compensation strategies. That doesn't, you know, in sending people to work more when they're tired doesn't always work. It's not always a great strategy. But there are many folks that work part-time that might be interested. We have people in other areas, our clinics, for example, who have really stepped up and have been willing to help us as well. And then rewarding people who are precepting new graduates, for example, those very experienced nurses. So compensation is a piece of it. The other thing we've been very focused on now is looking at the work that's there and trying to back off and remove some things that aren't critical right now. And that doesn't sound like much, but if you're the manager and you're always, can you identify a nurse for this committee or that group? It's very important to have that nursing voice there, but this may not be the best time to have a lot of other additional activities when we're going through an additional surge. So our organization has been very supportive of continuing to focus on quality, safety, but maybe pulling back a little bit from some of the meetings and those type of things that take time away from the bedside. Another thing that we've done, and I think other organizations have as well, is there is an opportunity to look at your electronic health record and how nurses document and tailor that during crisis situations, really begin to say, what are the essentials? And we implemented that during the other surges and now are again allowing each site to determine based on their needs, whether or not they need to do that. So focusing again on recognition, reward, whether it's compensation or other areas, but also really looking at the work that nurses are doing. The other thing I would add is that we have had a great partnership. Nursing has had a great partnership with our employee health services, our employee assistance services, and behavioral health. And so we've been able to identify appointments and support for people who are, you know, people get stressed and people get anxious. And then there are many people who are really having such a difficult time that they've got to seek additional help. And we've been able to provide those services as well.
All right. Well, Mary Beth, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
I'm delighted to be here, and many thanks to all the nurses at Advocate Aurora Health throughout our country and certainly throughout Wisconsin.
Mary Beth Kingston is the Chief Nursing Officer for Advocate Aurora Health. We spoke last month about the nationwide nursing shortage. Coming up in about 12 minutes, two herpetologists, or people who study amphibians and reptiles, will talk about a new species of boa found in the Dominican Republic and how the Milwaukee Public Museum was involved. But first, we'll hear from Eddie Daniel about his new book that looks at the progress made on the Milwaukee River Greenway. That's coming up next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. The Milwaukee River Greenway stretches 8 miles, beginning where the North Avenue Dam used to stand just upstream from downtown Milwaukee and ends at Silver Spring Drive in Glendale. Its 878 acres has everything from managed parkland to wetlands and forests. the Greenway owes its existence to a grassroots coalition that set to work 15 years ago with a shared mission to preserve a natural experience in an urban area. Local photographer and writer Eddie Daniel has explored every path within the Greenway with his camera in hand. His new book, The Milwaukee River Greenway, A Wealth of Nature in the Heart of the City, includes not just Daniel's photographs, but stories of the people who stewarded the river long before Milwaukee was Milwaukee. WUWM environmental reporter Susan Bentz met Daniel along the Greenway in August to talk about his book.
I've been working on this particular book for almost 2 years now, but it includes pictures that I've taken over many, many years, because we want to cover as much time as well as territory as possible.
Part of this coming together is that you were an artist in residence on the river as well.
Yes. So I'm artist in residence for River Revitalization Foundation, which is also the publisher of the book. And it's through a program called Art Servancy, which is a wonderful program that was begun by, it was a partnership between Gallery 224, which is in Port Washington, and the Ozaukee Washington Land Trust. Back in 2018, they began the partnership, just those two organizations. And the purpose of it is to highlight both the artists who are involved and the land trust properties that they are serving in. And they've expanded, obviously, into Milwaukee County last year. And this year, there are five different land trusts that are involved.
You were introduced to the green of the city back in 1977 when you moved here?
Yes. When I moved here, I went to school in Madison, and after graduating, I moved to Milwaukee, and I happened to land right next to the Milwaukee River. My career was as a teacher, but I've been involved with nature, and I love camping and outdoor activities. So when I moved here in 1977, happened to find the Greenway, it was not called that then. In fact, it was considered dangerous, which is an important part of the story. And, you know, the book includes much of the history. An important piece of that history is the transformation that's happened. And I can't say this emphatically enough, largely due to the Urban Ecology Center. Not only them, but they really got it jump-started. Riverside Park in particular was considered dangerous, and when the Urban Ecology Center began, their express purpose was to take back the park and to make it safe and to make it popular again, and they succeeded beyond anyone's wildest dreams, I think.
You've said that you have always loved unkempt nature. How much unkempt nature do we have left in the confines of the Greenway?
It's less unkempt than it used to be, and that's by design. I mean, we want it to feel safe, and so it does. The trails have been expanded and to make them more comfortable for people and inviting and welcoming and accessible in many cases. And so that's made it a little less wild than it was when I first discovered it back in the 70s. But the wonderful thing is that it's still unkempt enough that you get that sense. I mean, it's managed, obviously, parks like where we're sitting here in Estabrook at a picnic table with the Parkway Drive, you know, right here. It's a regular traditional park. But if you walk just that way and down the bluff, it becomes very wild seeming.
You know, you go through the history, fold in voices of people who live on the river, who, for whom the river has meaning. John Goethe wrote your foreword.
Yes. Yes. John Goethe, as most people know, has been a very important spokesperson for not only Milwaukee, but for Milwaukee's parks and natural areas. I mean, it was very gratifying to me to have him agree to sign on for this. He didn't just write the foreword, he also contributed a story to the rest of the book, which is made up of stories by quite a variety of people. It was important to us to have a diversity of voices, and I think we achieved that.
Just a couple of examples of voices are Vicki Williams and Vince Bushell. Talk a little bit about their contribution.
Vince was a staff person for RRF, so he was a natural person to ask. But not only for that reason, but because he lives in this neighborhood, he lives in the River West neighborhood, has lived here for a long, long time, and he's been a very vocal advocate for the river and all of this. So he knows all of this in a way that I don't. So he contributed much of the history. He knows way more about this area than I do. So his contribution was essential. Vicki Williams is only one of several Native American voices. I deliberately chose her story to lead off the stories in this because it's very poignant and evocative, and I really enjoy it myself very much. Her story is about the little people who are guiding spirits and who you need to make gifts to, and her story is about giving them gifts. And it is relatively wild, but you do want to be concerned about things like invasive species, people behaving properly, so to speak, using the trail respectfully and things like that. So there's a certain amount of management, but it feels natural. It feels relatively wild, which is one of the things that appeal to me particularly.
We're pretty lucky to have it.
Oh, lucky. That was what John Goethe said in his foreword, too. That was his concluding remarks. But having said that we're lucky, I mean, it is lucky, but it isn't lucky. It's because it took an enormous amount of effort. To say we are lucky is to minimize the importance of how much effort went into creating the Greenway. The organizations, of course, the nonprofit organizations, but also the political will that was required. I mean, it took some convincing, as you might imagine, but the political will, the businesses that were involved in any number of, certainly civic organizations as well as the nonprofit organizations.
In your estimation, what's going to take to keep this going? Are we free and clear? Is this going to take some ongoing stewardship and dedication?
Well, yes, it certainly takes stewardship. You can't have a place like this. And the main player is, of course, Milwaukee County Parks and cities and villages that manage these places, but also the River Revitalization Foundation, the Urban Ecology Center. They are all directly involved in ongoing way with the management and stewardship of the Greenway. And without that, it would become more and more unkempt, as we have been saying, and people would find it less inviting, which is one of the things that has been the positives that have come out of all of this, is that it's very, very popular, especially compared to when I first arrived here and kind of had to push my way through the trails, because they were so overgrown and that sort of thing. And now they're much more welcoming.
Eddie Daniel is a writer and photographer and author of the new book, The Milwaukee River Greenway, A Wealth of Nature in the Heart of the City. He spoke to WUWM's environmental reporter Susan Bentz in August.
Bubbler Talk, quenching Milwaukee's thirst for knowledge.
I'm WUWM reporter Emily Files. Take a look at a map of the Milwaukee suburbs, and you'll notice one is not like the others. The village of Thiensville is about 1 square mile and surrounded on all sides by Mequon. Bubbler Talk question asker Hannah Francis grew up in Mequon and now lives in Washington, D.C. She started to wonder about Thiensville during a geography lesson back when she was in high school.
We were learning about enclaves and exclaves, an enclave being a territory that is entirely surrounded by another territory. And, I was thinking about it and I was like, oh, well, obviously I grew up in one.
Other examples of enclaves include San Marino in Italy and Lesotho in South Africa.
So I just thought that was kind of interesting. And I tried to figure out kind of why, because in most cases that enclaves had happened on accident, most of the territories end up becoming one territory anyway.
Thiensville is a picturesque village of about 3,000 people located on a bend in the Milwaukee River. I stopped in Fiddleheads, a popular coffee shop on Main Street, to see if the question of why Thiensville is landlocked by Mequon occurred to anyone else. The barista had this response.
Oh yeah, I'm confused by that as well. So maybe I'm not the person to ask. It's so small, and then we go into Mequon, it's right there. I don't know, it's confusing. It's like in the center of Mequon.
For answers, I turned to Bob Blazek, a longtime Thiensville resident and president of the local historical society.
Mequon is like a donut, and Thiensville's the donut hole.
To understand how the donut came to be, you have to go back to John Henry Thien. The wealthy German immigrant was a free thinker, opposed to organized religion, who sought out a new home in Wisconsin.
When John Henry Thien came in 1842, he was a businessman and a miller. A dam had been approved across the Milwaukee River. He built it. He had a small tavern. He had a general store.
Thien's settlement became the hub of the town of Mequon. Farmers in Mequon would take their grain to Thien's mill, and other businesses congregated around it. It wasn't until Thien was long dead in 1910 that Thiensville incorporated as a village. There were 289 residents at the time.
In 1910, once we got the census here in Thiensville, they had a vote. And the people who lived on roughly 600 acres decided they were going to put boundaries around it and become a village.
Blazek isn't sure why they didn't extend the borders to include Mequon. One reason could be that Thiensville and Mequon had distinct identities. Thiensville with its freethinker roots and commercial center, Mequon with its sprawling farmland.
In fact, if you go back to the 40s and 50s, people in Thiensville almost had their own accent. You could tell where they were from because it was a very heavily German area. And they weren't from Thiensville. They were from Thiensville. Yeah, I live in Thiensville there. It's always had its own identity.
Mequon and Thiensville today share many things, a school district, a library, but they each have their own government, police, and fire departments. Blazek says consolidating Mequon and Thiensville would probably save taxpayers money. He doesn't see it happening, though.
I think people value their identity more than the taxes. I own another house here in Thiensville, and if it were 100 feet to the west, I'd pay $1,000 less in taxes on it. I don't want to be 100 feet west. I want to be in Thiensville.
It may be a mystery exactly why Thiensville residents in 1910 decided to create an enclave rather than including Mequon within their borders. But the small town identity has stuck, and the donut hole stands strong.
Support for Bubbler Talk comes from Landmark Credit Union and Palermo's Pizza. What have you always wanted to know about the Milwaukee area? Visit wuwm.com/bubblertalk to submit your question.
Bubbler Talk is a regular series here on Lake Effect, and you can hear it every Monday at noon and 8 o'clock. You can find our previous episodes of Bubbler Talk at wuwm.com. Coming up next, we'll learn how Milwaukee Public Museum and UNC Asheville researchers helped to identify a new species of boa found in the Dominican Republic.
From the very first photograph that we saw that Miguel took and sent to Bob and I, we both sort of had this feeling of, okay, this is not something we have seen before. This is not familiar. It was really exciting.
That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. There are three species of boa on the island of Hispaniola, the Caribbean island where the Dominican Republic and Haiti are located. Now, a fourth species has been discovered, the first new species to come from the island in more than a century. This boa, known as a Hispaniolan vine boa, is very small and was discovered in 2020 in the tropical dry forests by Miguel Landestoy during a night survey.
he confirmed the new discovery with the help of Bob Henderson, Emeritus Curator of Herpetology at Milwaukee Public Museum, as well as Dr. Graham Reynolds from the University of North Carolina, Asheville. Henderson and Dr. Reynolds spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski about this discovery. Reynolds begins by explaining the habitat of Hispaniola that makes it such a good place for boas.
The amazing thing about the island of Hispaniola is how topographically diverse it is. In other words, there are a bunch of mountains, and those mountains provide a whole bunch of different habitat types. And so we have the highest peak in the Caribbean, Pico Duarte, and then we have everything down from rainforest to very dry areas. All of those different habitats provide the opportunity for a whole bunch of different wildlife to find their own sort of niche spaces. And one of the fascinating things about Hispaniola with regard to boas is that up until, you know, this recent discovery, we knew that there were three species of boas on Hispaniola, and that's actually quite a few. Other islands like Cuba has only one species of boa, despite, you know, a large variety of habitats there. Jamaica has one species of boa. So the fact that Hispaniola had three was already quite remarkable, and that is what makes this new discovery even that much more amazing, is that there's not three, there's four species of boas. And of those four, three of them are highly adapted to very specific habitat types around the island.
So going into the new boa that was discovered, Bob, can you describe what this new boa species name is and describe the physical characteristics of this snake?
Chilobothrus ampelophis, in ampelophis translated, means vine boa. As boas go, it's very small and could possibly be the smallest boa or boid in the world, and very slender, adapted to an arboreal lifestyle. It has a very, very different looking head, which is one of the things that first attracted the co-describer and the discoverer of the boa, Miguel Landestoy. He's the one who noticed just that the shape of the head was really interesting, very different from the other three species that occur on Hispaniola. And Miguel did all the morphological work on the boa, and Graham did the genetics, and I kind of just watched them do all the work. So Graham is actually seeing specimens of the boa, and he'll be a better person at describing it for you.
Yes, please, Graham.
Sure. Well, what strikes me initially is how small they are. They are just so tiny, even among this group of boas in the Caribbean that has a large range of body sizes already. Some of the largest species can be over 4 meters long. Some of the smaller species less than a meter. But even among that range, this really stood out as being really small. And so when you hold the little specimen in your hand, it's just remarkable how small and skinny they are for a boa. And then in addition to that, of course, yeah, the head shape is quite different than the other boas that Bob and I have seen on all these islands. And, you know, we have this sort of understanding that when we look at a boa, we recognize them, right? And so when you see something new, it instantly jumps out in your mind as being something different. And that's certainly what happened with this new species. From the very first photograph that we saw that Miguel took and sent to Bob and I, we both sort of had this feeling of, okay, this is not something we have seen before. This is not familiar. It was really exciting.
So you mentioned when you hold it in your hand, you're surprised at how small it is. So how much of your hand is it taking up? And how do you know that's its full size? I mean, it was first sighted back in 2020. So how are you guys keeping track of, you know, what is a reasonable estimation of this is its true length? It won't get any bigger than this.
Right. So that's always a hard question to ask. A lot of snakes have what we call indeterminate growth, which means that they continue to grow throughout their lives. The boas are sort of like that, although some of them certainly slow down quite a bit and seem to top out at a maximum length. But when you hold this new boa species in your hand, if it's coiled up, it fits within the palm of your hand. And it's just a remarkable fact, you know, that a boa could do that. In terms of estimating, we are able to tell that these are sexually mature, therefore adult individuals. But it's going to be very hard to answer that question of how big can they get. And the best way to do that is with large sample sizes. The more you look at, the better range of body sizes you can find. And so that is going to be our goal moving forward, is to see if we can find a lot more of these boas, get a better estimate of how big they might actually be able to get. Now, we can use some of the information we already know about the growth of these boas to sort of infer that they probably don't get much bigger than this. Right? So we could always be wrong, but from what we know about the other boa species, we expect that this is a small boa species, probably among the smallest.
Can either of you touch upon how one goes about confirming that this is a new species? You mentioned there was some DNA analysis.
Well, when we describe a new species, we have to sort of use definitions. But believe it or not, and this is something most non-biologists might not appreciate, is that the definition of species can be tricky. And so we have to take a variety of different approaches and different types of data in order to describe a new species. So, for example, with this boa, we're relying pretty heavily on looking at its morphology. So we do things like Miguel, our collaborator, was measuring the head shape, counting the scales, all these kinds of things that might give us a clue to how different the animal is from other species that we know about. And then my role was to look at the DNA. And so in that case, I have a whole database of DNA samples from all the boas in the West Indies, well, really all the boas around the world. And so when you find something new, we can sample the DNA and compare it to our database of known species. And so that's your first step, is if that new sample jumps out as being very different from what you already know about, well, that's your first clue. And then we have some more advanced statistical analyses we can do to show how different are they based on the samples that we have. And so that's exactly what we did. And it became very clear, and I like to call it sort of the smoking gun, because we can see that the morphology and the DNA are showing that this animal is different. And so for us, that's the evidence we're looking for.
So this new boa is very small. It inhabits a lot of brush, forest areas. With the climate of this island where it was found, how does the discovery of a new species highlight the need for conservation? I imagine the environment of this island has changed a lot over time, most likely because of human interruption.
It's becoming more and more difficult to find habitats in the West Indies that have not been heavily disrupted by human activity. And that certainly goes for the Dominican Republic, and even more so in the adjacent country of Haiti, where finding stands of woodland is becoming more and more difficult. But at the site where the new boa was collected, it's an area that had not been collected previously by herpetologists, although adjacent areas had been over the past decades. And even this was heavily disturbed, and it is in danger of additional disturbance from agriculture, from cutting for wood for charcoal. And this is a major concern of ours. We don't know how large this population is, but we feel it is probably a very localized population. And that concerns us a great deal, especially if there's a lot of human activity in the neighborhood there with the further disruption of the habitat. But again, that applies to virtually all islands in the West Indies. It's an ongoing problem, and it's not going to get better.
So is it because the forests have changed so drastically that a new species like this smaller, tiny, fierce boa can come about to adapt in this environment?
I would say it's because it has perhaps been fortunate in being in a place where there has perhaps been less activity than in other areas of the Dominican Republic. But also, we don't know how widespread this boa might have been at one time, perhaps more so than it is now. Right now, we're just aware of a very localized population. And one of the things we want to do, and I think Miguel is already trying to look at adjacent areas to see if we can determine how widespread it might be. But so far, all evidence is that it's very localized.
So why should the everyday person, even if they're not a fan of snakes, be excited about this discovery?
One of my favorite things to talk to people about is the depth and breadth of biodiversity. I mean, for us as humans to be able to appreciate the amount of biodiversity on this planet is already astounding. And for us to be able to appreciate the fact that here you have, you know, a relatively large vertebrate predator on an island that's been well studied for centuries that had not been recorded as part of the scientific understanding. I mean, that's just remarkable. And I think if nothing else, it serves to show that there are discoveries waiting to be made. We do not know, even scratching the surface, the full extent of biodiversity, even on well-studied islands. And if nothing else, that is exciting.
Bob Henderson is Milwaukee Public Museum's Emeritus Curator of Herpetology. Dr. Graham Reynolds is a herpetologist and researcher from the University of North Carolina, Asheville. They spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski about the discovery of the Hispaniolan vine boa. You can find pictures of the new species of boa at WUWM.com. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll learn about a new exhibit at the Jewish Museum Milwaukee that celebrates the history of recycling in America. Plus, we'll look at the city of Milwaukee's proposed budget, including how federal aid dollars could be spent. That's all tomorrow at noon, right here on Lake Effect, on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.